Carlos Nunez made forward progress, no matter the conditions, a daily habit. It was sadistic and smart all at once.
Iron Man is hard,
our crew exclaimed, raising drinks in the air for a toast. It was a story and a lesson we'd never forget. Chapter 7. Very Dumb Things. It was one of those days. Because I had forgotten to set my alarm the night before, I didn't wake up until almost 9 o'clock in the morning. Because I had gotten such a late start, I was riding my bike during the hottest part of a stifling summer day. Because I was riding my bike in the heat of the day, I was depleted. Because I was depleted, I was grumpy. And because I was grumpy, I was not in the mood to deal with Carlos's shit. And yet I had no choice. In my flustered rush to get out the door that morning, I had forgotten to grab spare tubes for my tires. I didn't realize my mistake until I was 40 miles out of town on a deserted road lined with puncture vine weeds. Their gnarly thorned seeds littered the road, creating a perilous obstacle course for my thin rubber tires. When I felt the telltale thunk, thunk, thunk of a flat, I plunged a hand into my jersey pocket and cursed as I realized my mistake. I really didn't want to text Carlos for help. One of the first things he'd done after I bought my bike was teach me how to change a flat tire, stressing that I always needed to be prepared and self-reliant. "Nobody likes to rescue a dumbass," he'd repeat on a loop. "Never leave the house without water, food, or flat kit." That day, I had only 2 of the 3 on my bike. I used my cell phone to text everyone I knew except Carlos, hoping someone would be willing to pick me up. But the replies ranged from busy to no car to you rode your bike to where? I considered my options. I could walk to the nearest gas station, more than 15 miles away, or I could wait for a car to appear on the desolate road, thumbing for a ride from a potential serial killer. Or I could text Carlos and admit that I had messed up. I looked up at the scorching sun and wondered if there was any benefit to befriending a serial killer. An hour later, a black car appeared on the horizon, slowing to a halt upon seeing me on the side of the road. A tinted window rolled down, and the driver leaned across the passenger seat to take stock of the disabled bike and sunburned rider.
"For someone so smart, you really do a lot of very dumb things," Carlos sighed, unlocking the passenger door to let me in.
"I'm not in the mood, sir."
"What did I tell you? Never leave the house without not in the mood," I hissed.
Carlos reached into the back seat and handed me an ice-cold bottle of water. I never left the house without a flat kit again. But unfortunately, that wasn't the last time Carlos had to rescue me from very dumb things. I was dumb tons of times, like when I read in a cycling magazine that losing weight would make me faster on the bike. I cut my diet down to 1,000 calories per day, hoping a quick weight loss before that weekend's ride would make it easier to stay with the group without getting dropped. I lost 5 pounds before that Sunday, and I felt like I had won. I was smart. But when we started riding that morning, my legs suddenly felt and behaved as if they were made of concrete. Carlos pulled me from the ride, took me to Starbucks, and stuffed me full of whipped cream mochas and maple-glazed scones until I felt like a human again. A very dumb human. I was dumb when I declined Carlos's invitation to join a group of friends for a monthly practice swim in a local lake. "I prefer the pool," I said, and it was true. The pool was clean and the lanes well-marked. I felt safe and capable there. It was the smart thing to do. But the pool didn't fully prepare me for my first triathlon, a local sprint distance race in which I entered the murky waters of the lake and proceeded to panic in spectacular fashion. Why are these people so close to me? Where's the black stripe on the bottom? Why can't I see my hand in front of my face? What is that thing floating up from the bottom? That's a lake zombie.
Oh my gosh, that is a lake zombie!
I popped up in the air, frenetically doggy paddling and gasping for air.
Lake Zombie! I screamed. Lake Zombie! Carlos, who was watching from the sidelines, doubled over with laughter. I was dumb on my first century ride, during which Carlos yelled over his shoulder a reminder to eat and drink every 30 minutes. I rolled my eyes and retorted that I had things under control, thank you very much. I didn't feel hungry, so I didn't eat, and, as I learned at mile 60, I didn't have things under control at all. Even then, I faked a smile and told him I was feeling fine, despite the mental chatter blaring in my panicky, calorie-depleted brain. This is it? This is how I'm going to die, in the middle of the desert, wearing neon spandex. Carlos, recognizing a bad bonk when he saw one, called for a break at the next gas station, where he silently handed me a cola and a bag of potato chips. It was unspoken, yet clearly understood. I'd done a dumb thing. I was very dumb 2 weeks before Iron Man, Wisconsin, when a nagging cold turned into a sore throat, which turned into an inability to swallow. I thought I was being smart by continuing to train, because I could sweat the illness out of my body through exercise. One day after swim practice, Carlos suggested that we go out for frozen yogurt to soothe my inflamed throat. I jumped into his car with excitement, and he drove us a mile down the street and parked. "This isn't the Froyo shop," I stated, pointing at the brick building in front of us. "Nope." Carlos got out of the car, opened my door, and gestured for me to follow him into the urgent care clinic. He did eventually take me for Froyo, after the doctor diagnosed me with strep throat and wrote a prescription for antibiotics. Even when he wasn't physically present, Carlos would still find a way to alert me when I was doing a dumb thing. When race day finally came around for Iron Man, Wisconsin, I did everything perfectly. I ate all the right things, I did all the right warm-ups, I entered the water at exactly the right time. I paced myself well on the swim, fueled at the appropriate intervals on the bike, and started the run feeling strong and fast. I was dominating. I was smart. In the early miles of the run leg, I saw my mom standing on the sidelines. With a concerned look, she waved me over to the curb and broke into a jog alongside me. "Carlos says you're going too fast right now. What are you talking about?" She waved her cell phone in the air. "I'm on the phone with him right now. Carlos is tracking you online. He says you're going out too fast and that you'll pay for it later. Slow down." My jaw dropped in shock. How had he gotten my mother's phone number? "Tell him I've got this under control." "He said you'd say that," she shouted as I pulled away to rejoin the main pack. "Don't be a dumbass." As I ran off in pursuit of the finish line, this time at a slower pace, I couldn't help but laugh. Chapter 8. Anyone can do an Ironman. No, really. Anyone. 14 hours, 23 minutes, 42 seconds. On paper, it seems like such a long time, doesn't it? In reality, those 14 hours, 23 minutes, 42 seconds of Ironman, Wisconsin went by way too fast. It was, dare I say, fun. It didn't start out that way. The days leading up to my first Ironman were fraught with second-guessing. That anxiety turned into full-blown panic by the time I picked up my race materials the day before Ironman, Wisconsin. Carlos had said that anyone can do an Ironman. Hell, I had witnessed plenty of anyones at other Ironman races. But as I looked around at packet pickup, all I saw were people who looked a lot like Carlos, incredibly fit, incredibly confident, and with impeccable bodies. They rode expensive bicycles and ran in top-of-the-line shoes. They walked and talked like they knew what they were doing. They likely had never encountered a major health issue in their lifetime. The worst vice in their past was probably the occasional candy bar. And then there was me. "I don't belong here," I texted Carlos in a panic. "Fake it till you make it, Lakey," he replied. I certainly felt like a fake.
When I set up the day before the race, more than one person commented on my unorthodox road bike, which stood out like a sore thumb in a sea of triathlon-specific rigs. I got a few incredulous looks when I said I'd only been doing triathlons for about a year. I was reluctant to mention much more about my life before triathlon, for fear I'd get laughed out of the race. I felt extremely out of place, a 27-year-old former chubster in a sea of fit, middle-aged, overachieving men with rock-hard bodies. Anyone can do an Ironman? Anyone? Heh. That statement was about to be tested. I recalled Carlos's words yet again as I floated in the water before the start of the race. The sun was rising over the lake, and the scene was remarkably calm. As I looked around me, I remembered something from watching Iron Man from the sidelines. Everyone in the water looked exactly the same. In our black wetsuits, goggles, and swim caps, we were identical, which meant that the thousands of spectators lining the shore would be completely and totally unable to pick me out of the crowd of 2,556 athletes in the water. I found this anonymity strangely comforting. At packet pickup, I was clearly different. I didn't belong there. On race morning, with only my head showing as I bobbed up and down in the water, I at least looked like a legitimate Ironman hopeful. For a moment, I was calm. For the first time since arriving at the race, I didn't feel like a fraud. I think I even mustered a smile. And then the starting gun went off, and I was thrown into the thrashing mass, where the only thought in my head was a cacophonous loop of, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit. But eventually, the waves calmed, the bodies stopped bumping, and my arms and legs fell into a steady rhythm in the water. Hey, wait. This isn't so bad. Don't get me wrong. It was challenging. Parts of that race sorely tested my abilities, and I used muscles I didn't even know I had. But considering that Iron Man was supposed to be a sufferfest, I never really suffered. Maybe it was because Carlos had trained me well in those months, weeks, and days leading up to race day. Maybe it was because I raced conservatively. Maybe it was because I had the support and love of my incredible friends and amazing family members on the course that day. Or maybe it was because it's really hard to suffer too much when you run out of the swim and everyone moos at you, a tradition of the Dairy States Ironman, or you have a crazy spectator in a pink Speedo or an Indian headdress running beside you up the hardest climbs of the bike course screaming, "Suck it up! Do you want to be an Ironman or not?" To my great surprise, I smiled and laughed as much as I grimaced over the course of those 14-plus hours. At about mile 15 on the run, I saw a lot of people begin to hit the proverbial wall. They were slowing down, rubbing their calves, walking, and sitting down at the aid stations. I braced myself for the same thing to happen to me. At about mile 20, I ran up beside an athlete who glanced over at me and muttered something I couldn't make out. I looked at him and asked him to repeat himself. "This feels like death. God!" He dropped back and began walking while I kept going. As I looked at the trail ahead of me, I thought about what he'd said and took stock of how I was feeling. Death? Really? I had never felt more alive. For years, I had woken up every day and used my muscles, bones, and skin without really thinking about it. I had never considered that the human body is capable of accomplishing amazing things. I had certainly never thought my own human body was capable of accomplishing amazing things. Yet here I was, checking off the miles under the power of my very own muscles, bones, and skin. It was an electric feeling. As I turned the final corner toward the end, I encountered the bright lights of the finish chute. For 400 meters, there were hundreds of people, all cheering, yelling my name, and beckoning me to the finish line. Their roars reverberated through my bones. I let out a roar, too. It escaped my body with a tremendous joy I had never felt before. I had started the race as an anonymous face among 2,556 Ironman hopefuls. When I crossed that finish line, I was an independent racer, I was someone who had achieved her goal. I was an Iron Man. It no longer mattered that anyone could do it. All that mattered was that I could do it. Chapter 9. A Test of Relationship Fitness. When your best friend is of the opposite sex, dating can be complicated. When your best friend is someone like Carlos Nunez, it's all but impossible. "I'm going to set you up with a very nice boy," Carlos declared during a Sunday morning ride. I cast a skeptical look to my left, where he was riding. "He better not be a triathlete." I relished my new identity as an Iron Man, entering more races and living a life in which I ate, slept, and breathed triathlon. But I would not date an Iron Man. I had swum in that dating pool before, and it had ended badly. Many triathletes, I had discovered, were nice to look at, but horrible for everything else. Arrogant and overly competitive, the men of triathlon were great training buddies and terrible life partners. Carlos knew I felt this way, yet he often urged me to give it another try. Specifically, I needed to give it another try with the guys he wanted to set me up with. Very nice boys from the local triathlon scene. I ignored his attempts to play matchmaker, seeking romance elsewhere. I dated a forklift driver, a software engineer, a cop, a professor, a coach. Not one of them, blessedly, knew a thing about triathlon. But as much as I tried to keep triathlon and my dating life separate, the two would inevitably intersect. I'd cancel dates because I was too tired after a long run or eschew romantic weekend getaways in favor of 100-mile bike rides. If a guy managed to stick around through all that, he still had another hurdle to clear: meeting my friends, who were all triathletes. "You look like you work out," Carlos said the first time he met the software engineer at a post-race brunch. "Yeah, bro," he said. "I lift weights." Carlos couldn't hide his amusement. "Oh, is that right, bro?" I kicked him under the table, but that only fueled his glee. Carlos peppered my date with questions about bench presses and clean and jerks, feigning interest before launching his first offense of the night. "I hear weightlifters have problems with small, well, you know." Carlos wiggled his pinky finger in the air and nodded at my date's crotch. The guy broke up with me that night. Other times, Carlos lacked the patience to play the long game with my romantic interests. "You know what? I'm just gonna say it," he sighed within 5 minutes of sitting down across the bar from my new love interest, a guy I'd met at a baseball game. "Susan, you can do better than this fuckwit." Our crowd of friends fell silent. The guy glared at Carlos. I glared at Carlos. Everyone glared at Carlos. Yet he just shrugged, seemingly unfazed by the tension he had created. The fuckwit's tires were squealing in the parking lot before our drinks even arrived. "Jeez," Carlos quipped, leaning back in his chair. "So sensitive." "Can you please try, just try, to be less of an asshole to the guys I like?" I said, seething.
"Sure I can."
Carlos raised his beer in a victory toast, gulping down his obvious self-satisfaction.
"When you start dating guys who aren't losers."
"Have I told you about Brian from my triathlon team? He's a very nice boy. You'd like him." He took out his phone to text Brian with an invitation to join us at the bar. "What part of 'I don't want to date a triathlete' are you not understanding?" I stressed, smacking his phone to the ground. But Carlos was undeterred. A triathlete companion would be competitive, yes, but I needed someone competitive to push me, he insisted. And maybe he was right. The guys I typically went for were clueless when it came to my lifestyle. A fellow triathlete would understand that I couldn't go out on Saturday night because I had to get up early for a ride Sunday morning, a recurring argument with several of the men I had dated previously. He wouldn't be offended that I needed to disappear for hours at a time to train, and Most importantly, he wouldn't judge me for eating an entire pizza by myself after an 18-mile run.
Also, he won't be fat,
Carlos stated.
I like big guys, I protested.
Carlos raised a skeptical eyebrow. I slugged him on the arm.
What? They're so huggable, like teddy bears.
A teddy bear who needs heart surgery in his 30s?
Carlos questioned, referring to the forklift driver. During our time together, he had required 2 stent placements in his coronary arteries, a direct result of years of cigarettes and a sedentary lifestyle, yet refused my offers to start exercising together or to help him quit smoking.
He had his good traits, though.
Susan, he was a loser, Carlos said.
Why can't you date a guy at your level? You always seem to find guys with nothing to offer.
Now a triathlete, on the other hand.
Yeah,
I said dismissively, motioning to the bartender for the check. I had had enough of this conversation.
In my head, it was simple. Guys in triathlon, Reed, insanely hot, wouldn't like girls like me,
Reed, clumsy and sometimes smelly.
They were fit, driven, and healthy. Though I was participating in triathlon, I didn't consider myself a triathlete. The real women of triathlon were svelte, accomplished, and fast, and I wasn't any of those things. When I looked in the mirror, I didn't see someone who had lost 70 pounds or accomplished amazing feats of endurance. I saw the awkward, overweight chain smoker I had been years before. I saw a loser. Turns out the body can change its shape, but the mind is much less malleable. Athletic guys had rejected me before I became a triathlete, and they would reject me now. Of this, I was certain. Where Carlos saw a perfect match, I saw the potential for rejection.
You want me to be seen in public with her? Good one!
I imagined the guy sniggering before walking off with a slimmer, faster woman from my age group. Then I met Neil. The first time we saw each other, I was heading toward the finish line of an Olympic-distance triathlon while he was starting the run leg of a coinciding half-Ironman race. I had a flower from the roadside weeds tucked behind my ear. He was wearing his game face. I smiled and yelled, "Are we having fun yet?" He shot me a look that said, "Why the hell are you picking flowers at a race?" But after the race, he approached me with a flirtatious smile, saying he wanted to know the name of the girl with the flower in her hair. I had a hard time believing he was actually talking to me, much less romantically interested. He was way out of my league. After all, he was a tall, chiseled, all-American type with a natural athletic ability that landed him on the podium at many of the races he entered. What I'm saying is that Neil was insanely hot, and I wanted very badly to touch his butt. Guys like him weren't supposed to like girls like me, but who was I to say anything about that? Blinded by butterflies and the possibility of kissing a good-looking boy, I accepted his invitation to meet for a cup of coffee later that week.
No, Carlos said when I told him. You can't date him.
My face scrunched in confusion.
I thought you wanted me to date a triathlete.
I have some very nice boys to set you up with, yes, Carlos said. He is not one of them.
Is there something wrong with him?
I clutched my imaginary pearls, preparing to hear the news that he was a philanderer, an axe murderer, or, worse, an Oakland Raiders fan. Carlos pursed his lips in anger before leaning forward and hissing,
"He's faster than me."
It turned out that Neil had narrowly edged out Carlos in the finish chute at a race the year before. I tried, and failed, to contain the fit of giggles that bubbled up from my belly. It was all so ridiculous. A few months after our first date, Neil and I were going strong. One Saturday morning, I returned home from my long run to find Neil in my apartment. He was in the middle of a 6-hour ride, and I'd told him he could use my sink to refill his water bottles.
"Hey, babe," he said, as he leaned in for a quick kiss. "Good run?"
"Yeah," I said. "How's your ride going?"
Pretty good, he said, turning on the faucet as I rummaged in the fridge for something to eat.
By the way, I saw your friend Carlos on the mountain this morning.
In shock, I bolted upright, hitting my head on the ceiling of the refrigerator. Until that point, I had avoided bringing the two of them together. Neil had no recollection of raising Carlos, and therefore harbored no ill will. If anything, he found Carlos's contempt for him mildly amusing. The same couldn't be said for Carlos.
Oh?
I chirped, trying to play it cool as I rubbed the burgeoning bump on my skull.
Yeah, you were right about him, Neil chuckled. He likes to throw his weight around. The guy tried to race me up the mountain.
This news did not shock me.
So, who won?
Neil looked at me with a confident smirk.
Come on, of course I won.
It was typically triathlete, arrogant and overly competitive. It was also kind of hot. After sending Neil off to finish the second half of his ride, I looked down at my phone. There was a notification from Carlos. I held my breath as I opened the text message.
Saw your boyfriend on the mountain this morning.
Please tell me you were nice to him, I replied nervously.
Why would you say that?
Carlos replied. I am always nice. As I rolled my eyes at the absurdity of that statement, my phone buzzed again.
He tried to race me, though.
Oh, yeah? Who won?
Don't be ridiculous, Carlos replied. Of course I won. A snort laugh escaped as I typed my reply.
Of course.
Neil was the first person to survive the Carlos test of relationship fitness, and although Carlos could never quite forgive Neil for being just a little bit faster, he grudgingly grew to accept that maybe I had found a very nice boy after all. Chapter 10 Squeezing the Lemon. The Santa Catalina Mountains rise majestically above southern Arizona, a stately crown atop the city of Tucson. The jewel is Mount Lemon, a 9,000-foot peak that juts into the sky. Lemon has legendary status among cyclists for its 29 miles of unrelenting climbs lined with saguaro cacti and mesquite trees that give way to soaring aspens and ski resorts. At the top, a bakery in a cabin dispenses cookies and hot coffee to weary riders before they descend to the desert floor. I had never fancied myself much of a climber. Despite a weekly excursion to ride South Mountain with Carlos, I never seemed to improve in my ability to ride inclines of any sort. Uphills were always a slog and a struggle. While friends seemed to get fitter and faster, dancing effortlessly on their pedals, I just barely got myself to the summit. I was perfectly okay with this weakness in my cycling ability, however. Flat courses suited me just fine, and best of all, they didn't make me angry. I never once threatened to throw my bike into a ravine on a flat course. Carlos disagreed, naturally, and so it became his mission to find and unleash my inner mountain goat. He claimed that his intentions were to see me become a stronger cyclist, but I knew he just wanted another reason to ride Lemon.
It's time for you to earn your big girl pants,
he said one Sunday as we coasted down from the summit of South Mountain.
We're riding Lemon next week.
No thanks, I said. It's a beautiful ride, Carlos said, gesturing wildly as he talked about the stunning flora and fauna we'd seen on our way to the summit.
Not happening.
It will make you stronger, Carlos argued. Think of how much you'll grow from this experience.
Not interested.
You'll get bragging rights, he said, puffing out his chest in a demonstration of swagger. Climbing the legendary Mount Lemon.
Nope.
I'll buy you a cookie at the top. Two of them, if you want. That got my attention.
Cookies?
Big ones.
Carlos held up his hands in estimation of their size.
Bigger than your bike helmet.
I mean, I've done crazier things for a cookie.
I capitulated.
Okay, fine. I'll do it.
As the week went on, I began to reconsider.
The more I read about Mount Lemmon, the more I second-guessed myself. I had never even walked to the top of a real mountain before, much less ridden a bike up one. True, I had spent plenty of time climbing South Mountain on a bike, but compared to Lemmon, South Mountain's 6 miles and 2,000 feet seemed like an anthill. An anthill that took me a really, really long time to climb, by the way. I wasn't ready to tackle a challenge almost 5 times greater than that. Just the thought made me queasy with dread.
"Can't make it tomorrow," I texted Carlos on Saturday night. "You're not getting out of this," he replied, unfazed.
To Carlos, a verbal agreement might as well have been a blood pact. He had zero tolerance for flakes. If you agreed to do something with him, you really had no choice but to follow through. Carlos didn't expect me to scamper up Mount Lemmon effortlessly, but he absolutely did expect me to show up. Besides, he reassured me, Mount Lemmon really wasn't that difficult. I pointed out our greatly differing opinions on what constitutes difficult.
"Yes, but that's because you're a sissy," Carlos replied. "I'll pick you up at 4 a.m. tomorrow, sissy."
The next morning, in a McDonald's parking lot nestled at the base of the mountain, Carlos polished his beloved bike while eating an Egg McMuffin and chugging a chocolate milk. I sat glumly on the curb, trying not to puke.
"Vomit if you want," Carlos said through a mouthful of breakfast. "You're still riding."
He tossed a bag of hash browns into my lap and gestured at me to eat. I thought about what it would feel like to punch him. The hash browns flip-turned in my stomach. Nerves amplified the effects of the caffeine in my coffee. Carlos whistled a lively tune as he unloaded our bikes from the trunk of his car. He was clearly excited to introduce me to Mount Lemmon. It was confirmed. I definitely wanted to punch him. As we clipped into our pedals and began the ride, my anxiety reached a fever pitch. A chilly gust flew down the mountain. My body was covered in goosebumps, partly from the wind, partly from fear. This definitely felt like a sign that I shouldn't do the ride.
"I can't do this," I said. "It's too hard."
"You're being a sissy."
Carlos rolled his eyes. "Come on."
He pulled slightly in front of me to diffuse the headwind. The higher we climbed, the harder it got. 3 miles in, the winds began to shift, coming at us from every direction. At mile 5, I began to curse. We had been riding for well over an hour, yet it seemed we had barely made a dent in the mountain.
"Is it like this all the time?"
I yelled over the howling wind. Carlos looked over his shoulder and smiled reassuringly.
"It's just a little breeze."
A little breeze, my ass. That wind was cold and stinging. When big gusts came, I had trouble keeping my bike upright. I looked over the guardrail to my right and gasped. There was a steep, rocky drop-off to the base. People actually rode this mountain for enjoyment?
"Those had better be some delicious cookies at the top," I thought.
About 7 miles in, we spotted a group of cyclists huddled in the corner of a lookout parking lot under a large tree. Carlos gestured to me to pull over.
"What's going on?"
Carlos asked as he dismounted from his bike. The group looked at him with disbelief.
"You're kidding, right?"
one said as he motioned wildly in the air.
"The wind?"
A guffaw escaped from Carlos's mouth.
"What, this?"
One of the cyclists pulled his cell phone from his jersey pocket and motioned for us to join their huddle. On the red screen blared an emergency alert. "Wind advisory, Mount Lemmon. Strong winds are expected to continue through this afternoon into early evening. Sustained winds over 35 miles per hour are expected, with gusts as high as 55 to 60 miles per hour." Feeling a not-small sense of satisfaction, I reached over and punched Carlos hard in the arm.
"I knew this wasn't a little breeze."
He shook his head in astonishment. We really did speak 2 different languages. Just then, a large truck pulled into the parking lot. Leaning into the intense wind, a ranger from the Forest Service yelled at us to get into his car. We all threw our bikes into the back of the truck and wedged our bodies into the cab, a circus wagon full of helmeted clowns. The ranger shook his head in dismay.
"What were you guys doing out there anyway? Who the hell rides their bikes in this weather?"
We all sat in silence, too shell-shocked from the ordeal to speak.
"Fucking spandex cowboys," the ranger muttered under his breath.
On the drive home to Phoenix, the silence continued. Carlos was shocked, I was angry, and we were both just plain exhausted. When he finally dropped me off at my house, he pulled out a small bag and handed it to me. Inside were several packages of cookies, surreptitiously procured from a gas station stop on the way home.
"Here," Carlos said. "These should hold you over until you actually get to the top."
It was the closest thing to an apology I had ever gotten from Carlos. I chuckled and gave him a hug. When I got inside my house, I collapsed on my bed and took a 3-hour nap. Upon waking, I opened my laptop and typed a Facebook status update on the day's events. "Lemon, the wind was below 40 degrees, above 50 miles per hour, and I never, ever, ever want to ride my bike again. Ever." I hit the post button and scrolled through my news feed. As it turned out, Carlos had updated his Facebook status, too.
"Wonderful day at Mount Lemmon today. Sunny and warm at the bottom and a little chilly at the top, always with a constant gentle breeze."
Different languages, all right.
Chapter 11.
Well, that's one way to win an argument.
In 10 years of friendship, Carlos and I had only one real fight. We bickered. Of course we did. He could be insensitive, and I was stubborn as hell. But we usually resolved our spats with a hard bike ride or track session, interspersed with curse words. I can't even remember the details of the fight. When we reflected on it later, I recalled a disagreement about a guy I was dating at the time, but Carlos was sure he'd said something about my bike, to which I took great offense. Either way, the fact that we had such a serious disagreement is kind of embarrassing, especially since it led to us not talking for about a month. As with the fight itself, the details of our communication hiatus are unclear. My version is that Carlos didn't return my text messages, while he insists that I yelled something about putting him in friend timeout until further notice. But as it turned out, the real reason we didn't talk for a month was because Carlos was in the hospital. Going about my business elsewhere, miffed and waging my battle of wills, I had no idea. Then one day my phone buzzed.
"Need to talk ASAP," Carlos texted, breaking a month's silence. "Meet for coffee?"
Not gonna lie, I puffed out my chest and chuckled arrogantly, proud to have held out long enough for him to crack. He's the one who'd given in. He was the one who'd reached out. He lost the fight. I won.
"Does this mean you're sorry?" I replied. "Sure, whatever," Carlos typed back. "Meet in 10, okay?"
His brusque tone struck me. He must really be having a hard time conceding defeat, I thought. I'll take it easy on him. Keep the gloating to a minimum. Carlos was already at the coffee shop when I arrived, tapping the table nervously. He looked tired and as if he had lost some weight. Nothing unusual. With an Ironman coming up in a few weeks, fatigue and pre-race weight loss were par for the course. I sat down at the table, folded my hands in front of me, and beamed graciously, prepared to receive his concession speech and get back to friendship as usual.
"I have cancer."
Those definitely weren't the words I was expecting to hear. Looking down at a napkin he was fiddling with on the table, he began to explain. A few days after our fight, he had started experiencing stomach pains. He'd blamed it on gas from a new sports drink he was testing for his next Ironman. The following morning, he had been constipated. He'd blamed it on dehydration and upped his fluid intake during his 100-mile bike ride that day. The day after that, he'd become nauseated. He'd blamed it on a bug his kids must have brought home from school. Nothing seemed to quell his nausea, though. He tried ginger ale and threw it up. He choked down Pepto-Bismol, and that came up, too. He couldn't keep anything down, not even water. Carlos went to the doctor, who sent him to urgent care, who sent him to the emergency room. There they discovered a large tumor blocking his colon. One day Carlos rode his bike 100 miles, and the next he had emergency surgery to save his life. The tumor in his colon, about the size of an orange, was cancerous. The cancer had spread to his liver as well. He was classified as stage 4 and given a prognosis of 6 months to live. He hadn't told anyone outside his family yet. He'd needed to wrap his head around it all before endeavoring to explain it to others. I was his first attempt. With unsettling detachment and still looking down at the table, Carlos listed his treatment options and specialists. He explained his surgical scar with clinical restraint. He spoke unemotionally, as if he were a doctor describing some other patient in some other place. His composure was almost as disturbing as the news itself.
"So that's the story,"
he gruffly concluded. I sat there, dumbfounded. This didn't make sense. He was sitting right across from me and looked fine. Shouldn't he look more sick? Wasn't he too young, too damn healthy, for colon cancer? How the hell had this happened? A million questions raged through my mind, yet I sat silent, too stunned to ask a single one. All I could do was stare at him, trying to comprehend what he had said. "You've got to be kidding me," was running through my brain like a news ticker. Suddenly, a light bulb clicked on in my head. He was kidding me. This was some kind of sick joke. Of course. It all made sense. I began to laugh nervously. "You're messing with me, right?" Carlos reached over the table and grabbed my hand, finally lifting his eyes to meet mine. During the entirety of our friendship, I had never, ever seen self-doubt there. I hadn't thought he was even capable of it. Carlos had always been so confident, cocky, even. But as he looked across the table at me, I saw something in his eyes I had never seen before. "Holy shit," I whispered. "You're scared."
"Of course I'm fucking scared."
"I'm... sorry," I stammered, still unsure what to say. I averted my eyes and shifted uncomfortably in my seat.
"Hey," he said, squeezing my hand. "I'm going to fight this with everything I have."
When there's a 99% chance of failure, most people hope and pray to be in that 1% of success. Carlos said he planned to neither hope nor pray. Instead, he planned to force his way into that slim margin and own it, because that's what cocky people do. They suit up, even if it's a losing battle, even if they're afraid. And Carlos was afraid. He was afraid that people would doubt his ability to survive. He was afraid he would pick the wrong doctor or select the wrong treatment option. He was afraid of leaving his wife to raise 3 children without a father. And, most of all, he was afraid of letting on that he was afraid. He made the rounds, first with friends, then with colleagues. Each time he shared the news of his diagnosis, his rehearsed monologue became more convincing. After about 12 repetitions of, "I'm going to fight this with everything I have," it really looked like he meant it. There were times when he showed cracks in his armor. At his first appointment with his oncologist, I saw his hands shaking so badly that he couldn't hold a pen to sign the required insurance forms. After a particularly intense round of chemotherapy, he could lose all conviction, weeping as he hunched over the toilet, vomiting. In between rounds of chemo, Carlos and I traveled up to Flagstaff for a weekend of riding bikes. It was summer, and we wanted to escape the heat by venturing into the cool mountain air. Despite my efforts to start a conversation, he spent much of the 3-hour drive fiddling nervously with the radio. As soon as we arrived in Flagstaff, we changed into our gear and headed out for a long ride in the sunshine. Carlos was quiet on the ride, staring intently at the road ahead. I could tell he was tired. The recent surgery and chemotherapy treatments had taken their toll. Yet he shook his head at every suggestion to take a break or ease up on the pace. That night at dinner, he sipped his beer silently and barely touched his food, looking ahead with the same intense stare.
"Well, good night,"
I said as we parted ways to our respective hotel rooms. "I'll see you in the morning." Carlos nodded tersely and turned on his heel. Minutes later, there was a knock on my door. As soon as I turned the knob, Carlos pushed his way through and quickly walked into my room.
"I need to talk to you."
His breathing sounded heavy and urgent. His eyes were wild.
"Seriously, man?"
I threw my hands up in disbelief.
"We just spent the whole day together, and you couldn't have..."
Carlos exploded, his voice almost a shout.
"I want you to write a eulogy for my funeral."
"What?"
"When I die, write it. Say nice things about me. I want my kids to think I was a good person."
"Carlos, I..."
"Please."
He sat on the side of the bed, looking at me with pleading eyes. I had never seen him so vulnerable. He had always been the level-headed one in our friendship. Now, with the tables turned, I wasn't sure what to do. I took a deep breath and sat down next to him.
"You are a good person," I assured him.
"The best. Your kids know it. I know it. Everyone knows it." Unsatisfied with this answer, Carlos shook his head and glared at me.
"Please,"
he said again. I reached out and placed my hand on top of his. "You are not dying any time soon, sir," I said with conviction. The doctor and his 6-month prediction were wrong. They had to be. 3 months after his diagnosis, Carlos was riding his bike for hours in the Flagstaff Mountains. What dying man could do that? "We will worry about your funeral many, many years from now." Suddenly, the worry lines on Carlos's face softened, giving way to an embarrassed smile.
"You're right," he said. "I'm just tired. It's been a rough couple of weeks."
Carlos gave me a hug, stood up, and declared that he was going back to his room to sleep. He paused for a second before closing the door behind him.
"Hey. Thanks."
"Anytime,"
I smiled. The door clicked shut just as my hands began to tremble. If he could pretend to be brave, so could I. Chapter 12. My Money's on the Underdog. The months following Carlos's diagnosis could only be described as a beatdown. A constant stream of surgeries and chemo kicked his ass. There were some good days, sure, but mostly there were bad days, really bad days, and occasionally fuck-this-shit days. But through the ups and downs, one thing remained constant. Carlos was a fighter. Many fights aren't won in the first round. Sometimes there is round after round of fancy footwork and finesse, jabs and uppercuts. The fighters get tired and worn down as the roar of the crowd rises to dizzying volumes. Then, finally, in round 12, one fighter, wiping his bloody nose, sees a final opportunity and takes it. A staggering, beautiful blow. Sometimes the winner is the one everyone expected. The Alis, the Foremans, and the Mayweathers of the world are often a sure bet. But every now and then, it is the underdog who strikes that final blow, causing howls of shock in the crowd. In the matchup of Cancer versus Carlos Nunez, I had my money on the underdog. After Carlos's first surgery to remove the tumor from his colon, his doctor told him to use the morphine pump as needed and go for a light walk whenever he felt up to it. He'd be released in a week, the doctor estimated. Like a true triathlete, Carlos did what he called track repeats in the hospital hallways, pushing his IV pump all the way. He was released from the hospital in just a few short days. When a drug shortage caused his doctor to ration critical drugs and deny a life-saving chemotherapy component to many patients, Carlos saw many cancer patients at his treatment center give up, believing there was nothing they could do. Carlos refused. He wrote letters, made phone calls, and was a stubborn and tenacious presence in the treatment center until he was receiving his full chemo treatment every single time. When the chemotherapy destroyed his white blood cell count, doctors told him he had to take a break from chemo treatments. Rest, they said, would be the only thing that would get his blood work back to normal. Carlos did a sprint triathlon instead. It was one of his slowest races ever, yet he had a podium-topping smile the whole way. After crossing the finish line, he slept soundly for almost 24 hours. His counts were normal the following week. Carlos's main objective was to live as normal a life as possible. Normalcy changed with every round of chemo, so he did what he could. When he was too tired to ride bikes, he'd be waiting at the coffee shop at the end of everyone else's ride for coffee and conversation. On days when he was too sick to leave the house for coffee, he'd email to ask how a ride had gone. Even in absentia, Carlos was everyone's loudest cheerleader and toughest coach. Cancer is a bully of a disease that aims to weaken and embitter, but for Carlos, it had the opposite effect. "Have you eaten in the last 24 hours?" the nurse asked while preparing the latest infusion of chemotherapy drugs. Before every session, she ran down a checklist of the same questions, and it bored Carlos to no end. Why didn't anyone at the hospital want to talk about books or politics or what Jon Stewart had said on his show the previous night? "Are you kidding me?" Carlos replied cheerfully. "I downed a couple donuts, a hoagie, and a few sticks of butter on the car ride over here. Chemo really works up an appetite." The nurse, unmoved by his attempt at humor, continued her stern-faced prep without even looking up. An IV needle punctured Carlos's skin. Dials were calibrated. "Uh-huh. Any health conditions we need to know about?"
"There's something you should probably know," Carlos stage whispered. "I have a little bit of cancer."
Stern nurse was not amused.
"Noted,"
she said through pursed lips.
"Tough crowd. Are you allergic to anything?"
Undeterred, Carlos leaned back in his recliner and grinned as the drugs began to flow into his system.
"Sure," he said. "Kryptonite."
From his recliner, Carlos struck a Superman pose, the wires and tubes of his chemo pump forming a de facto cape flapping in the wind. For the first time in more than a dozen rounds of administering Carlos's chemotherapy, Stern Nurse cracked a smile. It was the underdog's knockout blow. Chapter 13. Wasted. During the week, Carlos filled his days with hospital visits and pharmacy refills, but Sunday mornings were still ours. One Sunday, after the bikes had been put away and the coffee brewed, Carlos tilted his head to one side and looked at me with an astute smile.
"You know, you've really grown up since I first met you," he said, taking a sip of his mocha. "You're not such a fuck-up anymore."
"That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me," I said with a laugh, knowing how hard it must have been for him. The man could give an outstanding pep talk, but compliments were not his strong suit. I should have been flattered, yet inside I was cringing. Because the truth was this. I was still a total fuck-up. I had just gotten better at hiding it. I lied a lot. I lied when my boyfriend asked why I had been acting so strangely the night before. I lied when colleagues asked why I was late for work. I lied when friends asked, "We talked about this last night, don't you remember?" And I lied when my doctor inquired about my drinking habits during my yearly checkup. "Oh, you know, just socially." I lied about my reasons for buying wine in a box, even though there is really no good reason why a single woman, living alone and drinking socially, should ever require a box-sized quantity of wine. I lied about why there was an empty box of wine under my bed. I lied when I was arrested for driving under the influence, blowing a blood alcohol level almost 2 times the legal limit. And I lied a lot on Sunday mornings.
In my mind, dishonesty was a lesser crime than disappointment. I had successfully maintained the illusion that I could be all things to all people. In the course of a single day, I could be a stellar employee, doting girlfriend, loyal friend, and tenacious triathlete. I could have it all. Hell, I did have it all. My life was pretty great. And I was absolutely convinced that this success was a cosmic mistake. I feared the day when someone would realize my good fortune was a clerical error. It was coming, I was sure. I was not intelligent enough to be a college professor. I had only fooled enough people into thinking otherwise. I had a recurring dream of a representative from Iron Man demanding that I return my finisher medals. When I went shopping for clothes, I grabbed items several sizes too large for my body. An email from the editor of a running magazine offering me a monthly column was surely meant for someone else. Whenever Neil gazed lovingly in my direction, I wanted to grab him by the shoulders and shake him. Wake up! Don't you know you can do better than me? This was not false modesty. This wasn't an aw shucks when someone compliments your outfit or says you had a good race. This was a daily, crippling fear that my life did not match the person living it. My case of the not-enoughs, which had crept in following my divorce, had advanced from a tiny whisper of self-doubt to a 24-hour klaxon alarm. Wine helped, plain and simple. That first delicious glass of red at the conclusion of every workday tamped down the volume. The second or third glass made me feel almost all right. Some nights, I was even able to achieve something that resembled relaxation. Then I woke up to empty bottles and dread. Sometimes the mornings brought a headache or a bout of nausea that would go away after a run and a shower. Other mornings delivered intense panic. I'd scroll through my phone, cringing at embarrassing text messages or Facebook posts I didn't remember writing, or stumble down the hallway to discover Neil sleeping on the couch. I didn't recall him coming over to my place. I didn't know why he wasn't sleeping in the bed with me. I didn't know why he looked so apprehensive when he woke up. The more I drank, the more I worried that someone would find out. The more I worried, the more I drank. I never intended to get drunk or drink myself into a blackout. I just wanted to feel all right. Sober me resolved to have only one or two drinks. Drunk me could never get enough. During my fugues, I'd polish off an entire bottle of wine and stumble down the street to procure another from the grocery store or gas station. As a precautionary measure, sober me started buying boxes of wine to keep drunk me safe at home. Drunk me would polish those off, too. When it came to alcohol, my brain had no off switch. My drinking was surprisingly easy to hide. If a college professor is tired, it's because she stayed up all night doing research or grading papers. If an athlete pukes during a workout, it's the result of giving it her all. No one suspects a hangover on a tough bike ride. I could still be all things to all people. If anything, I tried harder to be even more perfect in the daylight hours to offset my secret failures at night. The problem with lying is that the truth comes out eventually. In my case, the truth came out one Sunday morning. The bright sun poured through a bedroom window I didn't remember opening. The room spun as I groggily cursed the daylight and tried to piece together the previous night. Wine. I think I graded some student papers, too. Did I sign up for another race? I signed up for a lot of races while drunk. I groped on the nightstand for my phone. It wasn't there, only a puddle of spilled wine. I rose and stumbled into the living room, where a figure was sitting on the couch. Had Neil come over last night? "It's about time you woke up," the figure said, unmoving. I startled, sobering up immediately. "Carlos?" I blinked with confusion. "What are you doing here?" "It's Sunday morning," he said matter-of-factly. He was clothed in a cycling kit, his helmet on the cushion to his left. To his right was an empty box of wine. "I let myself in with the key you gave me."
That was supposed to be for emergencies, I grumbled. He had never just let himself into my apartment before. I was angry that he had crossed a line in our friendship. Oversleeping for a bike ride didn't count as an emergency. How dare he? Carlos handed me his